WFHR 1320 AM, W248DE Wisconsin Rapids, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Heather Bosch. Arrangements are being made to remember Charlie Kirk, the conservative activist who was fatally shot at an event in Utah. He was President Trump's friend.
He was a really special guy, so I'm going to be going to Charlie's, I guess you'd call it a funeral. There's a small one. I said, can we do the big one? Because we're going to give him the Presidential Medal of Freedom, which is a big deal.
A public memorial is planned for Kirk September 21st in Arizona. A 22-year-old suspect is in custody. Investigators are working to determine his exact motives. But there are growing concerns about heated political rhetoric. CBS's Christopher Cruz.
Social media is getting a lot of the blame for the anger that's pervaded our politics and infected our debates. Delaware Democratic Senator Chris Coons.
The internet is an accelerant.
Oklahoma Republican Senator James Lankford.
Social media is always pushing who's the angriest, who's the loudest, who says the craziest thing. That's what gets repeated over and over and over again.
Both men were on CBS's Face the Nation.
Online posts are facing scrutiny after last week's shooting at a Colorado high school. Governor Jared Polis telling ABC's This Week.
We pray for the recovery of two students who were injured with the gunshot wounds in Evergreen High School. The perpetrator, the reports are, was radicalized by pro-Nazi, anti-Semitic propaganda online.
The 16-year-old suspect died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. Clashes at a UK rally over immigration left 26 officers injured, 24 protesters arrested. The BBC's John Shea.
The British Prime Minister says the UK will not allow racial intimidation after Saturday's rally organised by the far right in London. More than 110,000 people waving the British flag attended the anti-immigration march in the capital, which was marked by what police described as unacceptable violence.
To Israel, where U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio is meeting with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Linda Gradstein reports.
Rubio's visit was being seen in Jerusalem as support for Israel, despite President Trump's anger with Israel for a strike on senior Hamas officials in Qatar that apparently failed to kill them. Speaking before an emergency Arab-Islamic summit in Doha, Qatar's prime minister called the attack state terrorism. At the same time, he said Qatar is willing to continue its mediating efforts for a ceasefire.
Medical staff in Gaza say the latest Israeli strike has killed at least 21 people. Hundreds of people named Ryan are in New York City this weekend.
It's so unreal. Just like to everyone's the same name as you.
Proceeds from the second ever Rye-Toberfest support pediatric cancer patients. This is CBS News.
Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. Get the parts and service you need fast from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
As Wisconsin is cheering on the Brew Crew. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
For Civic Media News, I'm Charlie Pittman. As cryptocurrency continues to rise in popularity, so do scams associated with the loosely regulated digital currency. Judith Ruiz Branch of the Wisconsin News Connection has more.
Cryptocurrency ATMs, or BTMs, allow people to buy digital currency using cash or a debit card. Fraud complaints about them increased by 99% in 2024, according to FinCEN. There are hundreds of them across the state, which are often referred to as federal safety locks by scammers. Courtney Anclam with AARP Wisconsin emphasizes anyone can fall victim, and more often than not, those who do are losing thousands to tens of thousands of dollars.
You might get contacted saying that there was suspicious activity on your bank account. You need to take all of your money out of your bank account because it's been compromised.
Two bills aimed at tightening regulations for cryptocurrency ATMs have been introduced in the Wisconsin legislature. The proposed laws would add to new BTM regulations set by the State Department of Financial Institutions this summer. They include daily transaction limits, mandatory registration for ATM operators, and anti-fraud policies like warnings on machines about potential scams. And Clam says they are great first steps toward enhancing consumer protections.
But we also know that folks need need to know warning signs of a scam so that before they get to the crypto ATM point of the transaction, they maybe start to become more suspicious and start to realize that this could be a scam.
The proposed measures also look to further expand consumer protections by requiring users to undergo rigorous identity verification during transactions and proposes to potentially refund fraud victims if they report the crime within 30 days. For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
As Wisconsin is hitting the road on your Harley, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Low clouds and fog giving way to sunshine with highs in the upper 70s to lower 80s and a light southeast wind. Tonight, a mostly clear sky. Lows will drop back into the upper 50s. A warm Monday on the way, mostly sunny, highs in the lower 80s. Right now, it's 76.
T. Schwaba.
On the next Nightlight, WGBW afternoon host and actor Eric Westfall joins in studio. Then Mental Health Warrior Film Festival founder Max Blaska joins. Let's light it up.
Nightlight with P. Schwaba. Weeknights from 6 till 8. You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review, and my name is Jim Santel. I am your host for this broadcast on the stations of Civic Media throughout the state of Wisconsin and beyond. Delighted and honored to have you with me and my producer Max on this solemn, profoundly disturbing, extremely tragic, and hugely confusing time in America. And yes, indeed, we are going to spend a good deal of our second hour here on Amicus, a law review, this weekend's weekly review and analysis of all things related to the rule of law and law enforcement and constitutional issues and government. We'll be spending a lot of time in our second hour providing some perspective of a constitutional dimension on what has happened this week, the violence of this past week, not only at the Utah Valley University, not only at the Evergreen High School in Colorado, but in other places around our nation, a nation that continues to be racked by violence. We're going to talk, as we have before, about some of the constitutional dimensions of both the First Amendment, the right to speak freely in America, the limits of that, the extent of that, and what it means in 2025, what it has meant throughout most of our history. We're also going to spend some time talking about the Second Amendment. That's right, the Second Amendment related to firearms, what it has meant throughout most of our history, what it has meant for just the past 17 years, the confluence of those constitutional issues brought together this past week, again, at a time of profoundly disturbing conduct, supremely tragic violence, inhumanity in our streets, in our places of education and beyond. We're going to talk about all of that and, of course, invite your perspectives and comments and questions. That coming up in the second hour of our broadcast here on Amicus, a law review. We're going to begin with other significant, also profoundly significant issues in America, beginning early this week with a major, yet again, another major decision coming out from the United States Supreme Court. This one, again, in the shadow docket, changing the way in which law enforcement does its job in America by virtue of overruling a judge that we have talked about before on this broadcast, changing the way that law enforcement, whether it's military or domestic law enforcement, specifically focusing on Los Angeles. We're going to chat about what the district courts in the Central District of California, which includes Los Angeles, have done in recent weeks, and what the Supreme Court did on Monday of this past week in overruling not only what a district court judge has said about the conduct of law enforcement in America, but also changing significantly, profoundly once again, the ways in which law enforcement is to understand its relationship with the people that it is designed to serve. We're going to be talking about Charles Breyer, a district court judge. We're going to be talking about Mame Frimpong, which once again, as we have in past weeks, and we're going to be talking about a decision, once again, not only by the Supreme Court not giving us insight into the reasons for overruling what Judge Frimpong has done, and a concurrence that's authored by Justice Brett Kavanaugh that gives us some insight into the reasoning, the perspectives of the Supreme Court that are stunning in terms of its condemnation, its rejection of much of what we have understood to be the focus of law enforcement in our nation. That begins our discussion here on Amicus Law Review. We are necessarily going to move from that into yet another theme that we have visited before, and that is the continued diminution of the rule of law in America. This one, as we have talked before, inside the federal judiciary, the dismay, the disarray that is happening as a result of the Supreme Court's continuing practice of issuing these one-line or two-line or two- or three-paragraph orders that give us and give lower courts no sense of the reason why they're doing what they're doing. It is called the emergency application docket. It is called the shadow docket. We have talked a lot about it on this broadcast and others. To this date, in this year alone, something in excess of 20 of these applications, a lot of discussion going on. We talked last week about some of what Amy Coney Barrett is saying about that in her new book. We've talked a lot about what people like Elena Kagan and Sonia Sotomayor have said in condemning this practice. This weekend, we talk about the further fracturing of the federal judiciary. That is judge versus judge, judges versus justices, based upon the incapacity of the lower courts to understand what our Supreme Court means, what it intends. It involves, yes, another Breyer. His name is Stephen Breyer, who in this mess of a time, at a time when the judiciary is fracturing, fraying around the edges, a former chief justice coming to the defense of a district court judge who felt the need himself to apologize, believe it or not, to members of the Supreme Court for failing to understand what they meant in these non-specific, undescribed decisions of theirs. If you follow all that, you understand where this is going. I'm going to straighten it out for you. I'm going to hopefully explain to you how we got to this circumstance and what it is that this event involving an apology from a lower district court judge to members of the Supreme Court for failing to do what they apparently assumed he knew they had to do. We're going to talk all about that, and then we're going to go from what is basically the First Circuit and a case there to the Fourth Circuit, another appeals court in our nation. We're going to talk about the disarray that it expressed openly from the bench this past week, Thursday, in connection with its attempt to try to understand another case on its docket, expressing concern across the board, an en banc proceeding. That is all the members of the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals coming together and scratching their heads collectively about what they are to do when they're given no direction by the Supreme Court, the further fracturing internal to the federal judiciary of understandings between and among them, the look from all of us to the Supreme Court for direction and assistance, and the continuing practice of our Supreme Court of not giving that direction. Why? Why? We don't know. We don't know. And that's part of the frustration. Again, we know that there are Supreme Court justices who are bemoaning the fact that they do not understand, as we do not understand, what is going on here, other than to say, as Ketanji Brown Jackson has said in recent times, that it is Calvin Ball. You may recall this reference that she invoked recently, saying there are two rules now in the Supreme Court, Calvin Ball, which comes from Calvin and Hobbes, that comic strip. She said it's Calvin Ball in the Supreme Court, which means there are no rules at all, or alternatively, the only rule that does apply is that the administration wins. Those are heavy words. Those are significant words. Those are condemning words inside the Supreme Court. We're going to spend some time talking this weekend, once again, about the fracturing internal to the federal judiciary as a result of the conduct of the Supreme Court and the failure of the Chief Justice to take a hold of this and make sense of it and do something as simple as either giving us directions, giving lower courts instruction, or simply deciding not to to take all of these emergency applications and to say, no, go ahead and have them litigated in the due course and have these cases percolate up as all of the other cases in the merits docket do. There are 65 of those, as we have discussed in the past, in this present term. There are about 32 on the docket of the Supreme Court term beginning anew in just three short weeks, the first Monday in October. That's the way it should happen. And again, we're going to be talking about the ways in which the present system fractured as a result of the shadow docket run amok in America, not giving us instruction, not giving lower judges instruction, a further diminution of the rule of law in a week that has seen a lot of that, a diminution once again in the peace that we think America should be all about, a diminution in the calm and the security and the safety that we should assume. And yet we no longer can assume that because of the violence in our midst. Once again, we're going to be spending a lot of time talking about freedom of expression, the limits of that. We're going to be talking about freedoms to carry and use firearms and the limits of that as well. First and Second Amendment issues. All of that coming up in the second hour here on Amicus Law Review. Necessarily going to be doing a little bit of rule of law snapshots, some things that have fallen to the cutting room floor in recent weeks, including just in recent days, a major decision by an appeals court upholding that major multi-million dollar judgment entered in favor of E. Jean Carroll against our present president for defamation, another First Amendment issue. We're going to talk about a Google judgment that another district court has entered just recently. We'll talk about the fact that Jair Bolsonaro has been sentenced just this past week, resurrecting discussions we've had in the past about him and the connections between Brazil and our nation and our president and that former president. And yes, time permitting, we'll talk a little bit about something positive, which is a Seattle Police Department oversight system from the Department of Justice, remedying problems inside the Seattle Police Department, now bringing those to conclusion, not prematurely, but after a recognition that many of the problems of the past there in Seattle have indeed been resolved. All of those things coming up here on Amicus, a law review. Those last things in the category of snapshots, important to understanding what is going on in our nation. And that is where we begin. Let us begin in Los Angeles, as we have before. Let me talk about one of the two Breyer brothers that we're going to be spending some time talking about this weekend. Charles Breyer, you may recall, a number of weeks ago, actually early in the month of September, entered into and issued an order effectively telling the administration that its use of thousands of military troops in Southern California by this president, by this administration, effectively turning about 5,000 Marines, National Guard soldiers into a national police force. Charles Breyer, federal district court, found, we have talked about this before, that that's illegal. And the president has no authority to do it under a number of analyses and not just interpretations, but sound legal conclusions entered by Judge Breyer, telling the president that he has no authority to do all of these things that he has done in Los Angeles. You may recall well the import and the effect of that order and the significance of a finding by a federal district court judge that the president does not have the authority to do what he is doing, at least in Los Angeles, the jurisdiction there. That is different. That is different, although related to another decision of one of Judge Breyer's colleagues. Her name, once again, Mame Frimpong. We have talked about her as well not too long ago. Again, a district court judge there in Central California placed some very significant restrictions on the president's efforts, even in the midst of the presence of that illegal force in Los Angeles. Restrictions on the capacity of that force, that military, now domestic force as well, to detain and arrest people on the streets, and involving also ultimately mass deportations. You may recall Judge Frimpong ordered agents not to rely on several factors and to rely once again on what's called reasonable suspicion, which has been and always is the law of our land. When we come back, we'll talk more about reasonable suspicion, about Judge Frimpong, and about what the Supreme Court did with respect to her order earlier this week. All that coming up on Amicus, a law review.
This is locally grown radio, WFHR.
If your credit card bills have gotten out of hand, call Consolidated Credit now. If the interest rates on your credit cards are so high, it'll take years to get out of debt, call Consolidated Credit now. They've helped over 10 million people. Without destroying your credit, they can reduce your interest rates, lower your total payments up to 50% to get you out of debt fast. For a free consultation, call Consolidated Credit now. The program works.
Call 800-210-4298. 800-210-4298. 800-210-4298.
Consolidated Credit Solutions Incorporated, 5701 West Sunrise Boulevard, Fort Lauderdale, Florida 33313. Licensed by the New York Department of Financial Services and by the Vermont Department of Financial Regulation. Kansas CSO 0019051. Maryland DM 1492. Oregon DM 892. Licensed by the Virginia State Corporation Commission. License number DC83. Service may adversely affect the individual's credit. Non-payment of debt may lead to additional finance charges or collections activity, including legal action. Actual interest rates, length of program, and monthly payment reductions will vary by consumer and creditor. Yours could be higher or lower. Not a loan company. We do not lend money.
Looking to give back to your community? Visit volunteerwisconsin.org to find volunteer opportunities near you. Join us in celebrating United Way's month by getting involved. Visit volunteerwisconsin.org or contact your local United Way today. Paid for by United Way of Wisconsin.
It's the Eco Minute, powered by Clean Wisconsin, your environmental voice since 1970. I'm Amy Berrio. Hunters, beware what you eat. Wisconsin health officials have issued a new consumption advisory for ducks harvested on Green Bay. Testing shows mallard and wood ducks on the bay are contaminated with toxic PFAS forever chemicals. UW-Madison researchers have linked contamination in the bay to Tyco Fire Products near Marinette. A key research center on the Mississippi River is falling prey to big federal cuts targeting science. The French Island facility, known as an ecosystem research area, produces information on water quality, invasive species, wildlife diseases, and more. Heavy cuts to the program take effect on October 1st and could effectively eliminate more than a century of scientific research. Knowledge is power. Right now on the Defender podcast, $150 million is available to help Wisconsinites upgrade their homes and cut energy use. Learn how to get started at cleanwisconsin.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
As Wisconsin is saying the word bag instead of bag, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
My name is Jim Santel. This is Amicus, a law review on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. I thank you. I appreciate your involvement in our very important discussion this weekend of the rule of law, of the involvement of government in our lives, the importance of the Constitution of the United States of America, and the role that judges play. If you want to be a part of that discussion, you can call Max, my producer, and me at 855-752-4842. That number once again is 855-752-4842. You can also drop a note into our chat box and be a part of our important discussion. We are beginning that review, that analysis here on Amicus, a law review, by talking about something that the Supreme Court did on Monday of this past week that once again changes dramatically the relationship that each one of us has with law enforcement in America, the way in which they conduct their jobs in service to us, their constituents. It is yet another example of the shadow docket run amok in America, although this time we've got some gloss, some explanation, if you will, from one of the justices that provides even more reason for discontent and dismay and wonder about what the Supreme Court is doing. Let's back into that once again by talking about Judge Mame Frimpong. I have spoken a lot about her in the past because she is the one who was assigned to this matter, to this case, even as the military and domestic law enforcement was in and remains in Los Angeles trying to address issues related to immigration and public protest and all those other things, hugely controversial. Controversial there, of course, in other places around the country. The aggressive law enforcement operations there, encounters, many of them captured on video, rounding up Hispanics and other people in that area by armed agents, became the source, the predicate for a lawsuit brought by some civil rights groups, some individuals. They were accusing the administration, again, of placing military and placing those military folks in a domestic situation in an unconstitutional way, engaging in unconstitutional illegal sweeps of thousands of people, arresting them, detaining them, bringing into them custody. The complaint that they brought, a civil rights complaint in the federal court there in Los Angeles, said that the administration was guilty of quote, indiscriminate immigration operations, sweeping up thousands of day laborers, car wash workers, farm workers, caregivers, and others. And as a result of that, the complaint went on to say individuals of brown skin are approached or pulled aside by unidentified federal agents suddenly and with a show of force and made to answer questions about who they are and where they are from. That, according to the complaint, the civil complaint under the Fourth Amendment prohibition against unreasonable searches and seizures. Now, that case, that civil case, long ago, and by that I mean weeks ago, assigned to Judge Mame Frimpong. She's a district court judge in Los Angeles, and she has a hearing, and she takes testimony and evidence on all this. She hears from people who describe exactly what the complaint describes in writing. This is not a judge who simply read the complaint and said, I'm going to respond. She took testimony under oath of people who describe the things that happened to them and to others. And she made specific findings about all this. We discussed those in the past. And in the end, she placed these very significant but longstanding restrictions on President Trump's effort to do what he is attempting to do with respect to immigration arrests there and in other places. She ordered agents basically to comply with the law that has been in place for decades, if not longer, in America, that requires that when police officers detain and arrest someone on the streets of our nation and our cities, our municipalities, our towns, our villages, that they have what's called reasonable suspicion to believe that that person is engaged in a violation of the law, that they have committed some crime, perhaps some violation of the law, to give them the suspicion that is reasonable to believe that that person should, in fact, be detained, taken into custody. It is the lowest standard possible when it comes to law enforcement. This is not probable cause. This is not clear and convincing evidence. This is not compelling evidence. It certainly is not proof beyond a reasonable doubt, but it gives law enforcement a standard by which to arrest, if appropriate, people on the streets. And yes, indeed, it is invoked routinely by good and decent and proper law enforcement authorities throughout our nation every single day in America. What Judge Frimpong said is because you've got to have reasonable suspicion, what you can't rely upon are things like race or ethnicity. You can't rely upon, you can't detain people simply because they're speaking English or some form of accented English. You can't arrest or detain people because they're found at a particular location, and that includes, for example, a place of day labor or an agricultural site. You can't detain people because they're performing a particular kind of work. You can't do any of that. Why? Because none of that is illegal. None of that rises to the level of a reasonable suspicion. And so she says, Mr. President, when you send these troops, and when domestic law enforcement also engages in these mass arrests, you've got to make certain that you're doing it based upon reasonable suspicion. She's not shutting it all down. She is saying that, yes, indeed, if people have committed crimes or perhaps have committed criminal acts, they should be detained. They should be arrested. But law enforcement has got to have a basis upon which to do that. And that has been the law. It goes up to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. We've talked about that as well. The Ninth Circuit looks at Judge Frimpong's decision and says, yes, indeed, this is the law, not just in Los Angeles, not just in California, but throughout the United States of America. It's reasonable suspicion. It is how law enforcement officers are taught every single day of the week. It's what I taught when I was an assistant United States attorney, when I was U.S. attorney, and most recently had the great privilege and honor at the invitation of one of our now former sheriffs in Milwaukee County to teach this very issue
to incoming deputies of the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Department. We do this all the time. It's reasonable suspicion. And she said, abide by the law. The Ninth Circuit said, yes, abide by the law. Abide by the law when you come in and make these detentions and these arrests. In the end, the Supreme Court said no. And on Monday, reversed that, vacated that opinion. When we come back, I'll tell you about the stunning decision of the United States Supreme Court in the wake of that decision by this district court in Los Angeles. That, as Amicus Law Review continues.
Locally grown radio, WFHR. As Wisconsin is cheering on Bucky Badger, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
CBS News Brief. Utah Governor Spencer Cox on the fatal shooting of conservative activist Charlie Kirk while appearing at a university in his state.
If your view of America is not shaken right now, then there's something wrong with you. This is a direct assault on America, a direct assault on every single one of us.
Cox on CNN. President Trump says Memphis is the next city he plans to send National Guard troops to. This resident says,
Memphis is great. I don't think we need the National Guard. There's way worse things going on in the world that they should be worried about, but no one's getting assassinated here.
Secretary of State Marco Rubio is in Israel meeting with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who says,
I think his visit here is a testament to the durability, the strength of the Israeli-American alliance. It's as strong and as durable as the stones of the Western Wall that we just touched.
CBS News Brief, I'm Heather Bosch.
The Brewers head to the playoffs. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Baseball, the Milwaukee Brewers, with the best record in baseball, clinched a spot in the playoffs, then won a thriller last night, 9-8 over the Cardinals in 10 innings. The crew down 6-1, came back to tie it up in the ninth, then finished with their 11th walk-off victory of the season. After wrapping up the series at AmFan Field today, they travel to L.A. to play the Angels Tuesday night. College football. The Wisconsin Badgers fell behind early, 21-0 at halftime, and went on to lose at Alabama, 38-14. Luke Fickell after the loss.
We knew we had to come out here in the first half in particular and play solid, play poised, play confident, find a way to make some plays and on both sides of the ball, but really make sure that what we could do was make some adjustments at the halftime and come out the second half and make sure that we could put the pressure on them. And it's exactly opposite of what we did.
That's the Badgers head coach Luke Fickell with sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
On your entertainment beat, I'm Peach Wabba. When not trying to push her bathwater soap on lonely men or selling her good jeans, Sid Sweeney does a little acting. The Sidster will play a boxer in the upcoming film Christy, based on the real life of boxer Christy Martin. Born in small town West Virginia, Christy Martin realized at a young age she was a good puncher and capitalized on that skill to become the best female boxer of the 90s. Despite not being released yet, the film has had a few eyes on it and is currently pulling a 61% on Rotten Tomatoes. Actor Joel Kinnaman is not a household name, but he has a solid fan base, and he seems perfect for a good crime story. So it's no surprise he is the choice to play the lead role in a new crime drama called Bishop. According to Deadline, Kinnaman plays Bishop Graves, a weathered, experienced detective who chases a killer preying on San Francisco's elite, only to find out that the crimes have a connection to his own father. The series is currently in development at Amazon MGM. For more showbiz fun, tune into Nightlight with me, Peach Wabba, weeknights from 6 to 8 p.m. on the Civic Media Radio Network.
Are you looking for ways to give back to your local community? Use VolunteerWisconsin.org to find opportunities to volunteer your time with organizations making a difference near you.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Low clouds and fog giving way to sunshine with highs in the upper 70s to lower 80s and a light southeast wind. Tonight, a mostly clear sky. Lows will drop back into the upper 50s. A warm Monday out of the way, mostly sunny, highs in the lower 80s. It's 78 at our studios.
Does Donald Trump's big bill provide the largest federal spending cut in U.S. history? No. Spending cuts in the bill that Trump signed wouldn't be the largest ever, despite claims by Republican U.S. Representative Scott Fitzgerald. The original House version would have nominally cut over $1.6 trillion over 10 years. The final version cut even less, $1.2 trillion. With $4.5 trillion in tax cuts, the act will increase federal debt by a massive $3.3 trillion over the next decade. Nonpartisan analysts say the plan's cuts would rank behind a 2011 law's $2 trillion in spending cuts. As a percentage of GDP, it doesn't rank in the top 5%. I'm Trisha Young for Wisconsin Watch. Fact briefs are bite-sized fact checks of trending claims produced by Wisconsin Watch and GigaFact. Learn more at wisconsinwatch.org.
Todd Albaugh.
Hey, everybody. Join us next time. We'll take a look back at the weekend news and sports headlines and discuss Suicide Awareness Month and why the rates keep going up in the state of Wisconsin. Join us.
The Todd Albaugh Show, weekdays 2 to 4.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
This is Amicus, the Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. We are talking about the rule of law, as we always do on this broadcast. Great concerns that all Americans should have, regardless of party, regardless of partisan views about things, which there are many in America. This goes to the core processes that all of us rely upon and through which we depend upon our government to make decisions and tell us what the law is. This lawsuit, resolved at least initially by Judge Frimpong in central California, in Los Angeles, in which she says you've got to have reasonable suspicion upon which to arrest people, goes to the Ninth Circuit, where it is still pending. By the way, they do not overturn her opinion. It is still pending, which is a part of what we see routinely when it comes to these shadow docket cases. But instead, the government, the Solicitor General, hear from him in just a moment or so, John Sauer, goes to the Supreme Court and says, stop what Judge Frimpong is doing. Tell her that she's wrong about this and let us do what we need to do to address this problem. And on Monday of this past week, the Supreme Court says, yes, we are granting that application. They do so without the normal review, without the normal briefing by attorneys, the oral arguments we talk so much about. And they issue an order basically saying, although not saying, that Judge Frimpong is wrong about this. The brief order, it's unsigned, gives no reasons, simply saying her decision is vacated, it's overturned. And we'll get back to the serious nature of that problem in just a moment. Interestingly here, however, one of the justices who is in the six-member majority, we know the three of them dissent on this, his name is Justice Brett Kavanaugh. He is in the majority, and he writes a lengthy concurrence, and he is the only member of the majority who does that, and he justifies what the Supreme Court has done. And so it gives us at least some insight, although it's horrific insight, into why the Supreme Court has done what it has done. He says this. He says about 10% of the people in the Los Angeles region are illegally in the United States, meaning about 2 million illegal immigrants out of a total population of 20 million. And what he is saying there, and what John Sauer, who is your Solicitor General, has often said and says again here in this petition for an emergency application, is doesn't really matter that we apply these standards, because if you ramp up and you bring together 100 people, statistically, 10 of them will have violated the law with respect to immigration or perhaps other issues. And so that's sufficient. That is sufficient statistically for doing this kind of thing. John Sauer, when he applies for this, he says that in many situations, these factors, which Judge Frimpong has described, can heighten the likelihood that someone is unlawfully present in the United States. He says above and beyond the 1 in 10 baseline odds in the district. That's your Solicitor General, your petitioner to the Supreme Court, saying, the odds are that we'll collect up some people who have violated the law, and that justifies it. Arguably, even more significantly, Justice Kavanaugh and the Solicitor General both say this. Any one of those factors that Judge Frimpong identified individually, that's right, they're not sufficient. Any one of those in particular doesn't do it, but if you bring them all together, and you put them together in a pot, in a soup, and even though individually none of them rise to the level of reasonable suspicion, then you've got it. If you put all of those together, you've got enough to arrest. Justice Kavanaugh said the four factors identified by Judge Frimpong can play a role, role, rather, in determining what the rules are when it comes to making these detentions. He said unauthorized immigrants often work as day laborers in landscaping and agriculture or construction entities. And many of those illegally in the Los Angeles area come from Mexico or Central America and do not speak much English. That's what the justice said. He said apparent ethnicity by itself is not permissible, not a basis alone to stop someone. But here we go. It can be relevant in consideration in combination with other factors. None of those factors providing that reasonable suspicion, but you put them all together, and then you've got a basis to arrest and to detain. I would offer to you that that is a stunning change in the way that law enforcement works in America. And indeed, this order is being condemned across the board, at least among those people who are concerned. Again, Republicans and Democrats alike, everyone in the political universe looking at this and saying, what is the standard today? After Monday, what is the standard now by which police on beats in America can detain and arrest people? In dissent, Justice Sonia Sotomayor writes that the administration and the Justice Department and Justice Kavanaugh have all but declared that Latinos, U.S. citizens or not, who work low-wage jobs are fair game to be seized at any time, taken away from work, and held until they provide proof of their legal status to the agent's satisfaction. She was also critical of Justice Kavanaugh's statement, his defense of what he said were the agent's brief stops for questioning. Justice Sotomayor responded to that by saying this: countless people in the Los Angeles area have been grabbed, thrown to the ground, and handcuffed simply because of their looks, their accents, and the fact that they are making a living by doing manual labor. Today, the court needlessly subjects countless more to those exact same indignities. Justice Kavanaugh says, well, if that happens, you can always sue those agents for use of excessive force. That's in violation of the Constitution. That's right. He's right about that. But that's the remedy. That's the remedy that Justice Kavanaugh offers in all of this. Again, the decision by Judge Frimpong was appealed to and affirmed by the Ninth Circuit, refusing to pause the order even as it continues to resolve the underlying issues. The Supreme Court decision is troubling, Justice Sotomayor says, for yet another reason, and that is it is entirely unexplained. Yes, indeed, you do have Justice Kavanaugh, who pens his own concurrence to this. She says that's a problem, too. She says in the last 8 months, this court's appetite to circumvent the ordinary appellate process and weigh in on important issues has grown exponentially. Its interest in explaining itself, unfortunately, has not. And so this major decision or non-decision coming from the Supreme Court on Monday, overturning effectively an appeals court, a district court judge, changing the way in which law enforcement works, done without description, done without explanation to you, to me, to others of all sides of the political spectrum. Everyone should be concerned about this. And indeed, not only are the people in America concerned about this, but so is a subset of people in America, and they are the federal judiciary, who are rising up more and more dismayed and disgruntled by the fact that they're getting no direction from the United States Supreme Court. Let's go to another case of justice past week, one of two of them. This shows the intramural disputes between district court judges and Supreme Court justices, present and past. How do we get there? You may recall a couple of weeks ago we talked about this confusing, serpentine, circuitous, use whatever adjective you want, decision about whether or not the Trump administration can cut these National Institutes of Health grants, about $780 million in grants designed to do all kinds of things. Supreme Court, again, issues an order. Five justices that let's stand for now the underlying ruling that the policy cuts are unlawful. But along the way, while it says that the policy underlying this is wrong, permits the $780 million in grants that were canceled, permits that cancellation to remain in place. It's confusing, at least. It's circuitous. It's scrambled. And all of us scratch our heads. Amy Coney Barrett finds herself in both majorities to further underscore the confusing nature of this and the fact that the Supreme Court does not give anybody more description about why these grants in part are canceled and remain so. But future grants those may not be, maybe, sort of, kind of, depending upon what the Supreme Court is meaning by all that. Well, it happens again this past week that the lack of decision-making, the lack of description by the Supreme Court prompts an apology, believe it or not, from a New Hampshire judge. And his name in particular is William Young. He's a federal district court in Massachusetts. And his posture highlights the great precarious position that district court judges around the country are now finding in trying to interpret what this is all about. Again, the NIH grants in particular, the Supreme Court issues this odd decision allowing the Trump administration to go ahead with the terminations while simultaneously signaling that the president's policy might be unlawful. So what happens is that in another case involving education grants, not the NIH grants, Judge William Young, Federal District Court, Massachusetts, he says in June that those grants in the education department can't be canceled. And he is scornful. He is dismissive of what the administration says. The grants, again, support all kinds of things like preventing suicide and chronic diseases and Alzheimer's and HIV. And the court, Judge Young, describes all that. And he denounces the cancellation of those various grants, calling the terminations appalling and declaring that it is his duty to call out the Trump administration on the apparently discriminatory calculus. He orders that the funding be mostly reinstated. And in the wake of his doing that, again, this is respect to the NIH grants, the Supreme Court, in particular, two justices along the way, they're Justice Gorsuch and, again, Justice Kavanaugh, say that Judge Young is acting in violation of what the Supreme Court has said because he's failed to follow what the Supreme Court has said in another case, also under the emergency docket in the education forum. Justice Gorsuch writes, lower courts may sometimes disagree with this court's decision, but they are never free to defy them. And he goes on to say, when this court issues a decision, it constitutes a precedent that commands respect in lower courts. And so Judge Young, who's resolving this NIH matter, is obliged to interpret the singular sentence or two in the education matter as applicable and follow that. And he gets admonished by these two Supreme Court justices publicly for doing what he is doing. And Judge Young, to his credit, comes back and he says, gosh, I'm very sorry. I did not know. I did not know that I was defying what you wanted me to do, justices. He comes back and he says, I never intended to that. He said implicitly, if not expressly, that the applicability of one emergency order as to another case was not clear to him. It comes at a hearing on Tuesday of this week to discuss how to move forward after the Supreme Court in August overruled his decision to block those grants involving those hundreds of millions of dollars in NIH. And again, in the wake of all of this, Gorsuch and Kavanaugh criticize him because he failed to follow what the Supreme Court has said when it comes to grants in the education area. Judge Young saying he had not realized he was expected to rely on a slim 3-page order issued with minimal legal reasoning in April to his case dealing with a different agency. He said this. This is Judge Young. Before we do anything, I really feel it's incumbent upon me to, on the record here, to apologize to Justices Gorsuch and Kavanaugh if they think that anything this court has done in defiance of a precedential action of the Supreme Court of the United States of America is intentional. Never intended to do that. He said, I can do nothing more than to say as honestly as I can, this is Judge Young apologizing to Supreme Court justices, I certainly did not do so. I didn't intend to do this. And it is foreign in every respect to the nature of how I've conducted myself as a judicial officer. When we come back, I'll tell you more about Judge Young's apology and the response by a no longer sitting justice of the Supreme Court defending Judge Young among this mess caused by the Supreme Court in its failure to provide.
Rebuilding and refreshing local radio one station at a time. This Civic Media radio station is proud to be a part of your community. Learn more at civicmedia.us.
There are so many traditions built around the Wisconsin Badgers, game day and the mascot, which in 1889 was a real badger. It didn't go well. Eventually, the animal was replaced by a person. An on-campus contest chose the official mascot name Buckingham U. Badger. Still, Wisconsin's official animal is a badger. But do you know which animal almost earned this title instead? Gray squirrel? White-tailed deer? Black bear? The answer is coming up. The original badger's nickname is actually associated with lead miners in the state, not the animals. It was the 1820s, and the miners often didn't have shelter in the winters, so they lived like badgers, digging tunnels into the hillsides where they worked. So was there almost another state animal? Yes, the white-tailed deer, which later became the official wildlife animal. But the history surrounding the badgers is a true slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
There was a time when barbecue was perfect. A strong, reliable flavor that could be counted on. But then big manufacturers decided that barbecue needed to be zesty or spicy or sweeter or whatever. If you miss the good old days of great tasting barbecue, we'd like to introduce you to Grandpa's Barbecue. Made in small batches from Grandpa's original recipe. Buy yours online today at grandpasbarbecueshop.com.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. September 4th, Native Nations asked the U.S. Supreme Court to uphold the longstanding right of individuals to bring voting rights complaints to federal court. If the High Court takes the case, its decision could have consequences for voting rights protections under the Voting Rights Act. In 2021, the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa Indians and the Spirit Lake Nation negotiated with the state of North Dakota to create voting districts which didn't dilute Native voting power. But after a 2023 Eighth Circuit Court decision in Arkansas, the state of North Dakota reneged on its deal with the tribes. The decision said only the U.S. Justice Department, not individual voters, could bring suits to enforce the VRA. Of 450 VRA Section 2 cases since 1982, only 18 were brought by DOJ. May 14th, a three-judge appeals panel affirmed that decision, but still only for the Eighth Circuit. After a July 15th stay, the nations asked the High Court on September 4th to take the case. Spirit Lake Nation Chair Lana Jackson Street said, "It is shameful that when we succeeded in court and got a fair map in place, the state turned its attack toward the Voting Rights Act and a person's right to vote free from discrimination. We need the Supreme Court to protect our fundamental right to vote and be heard." We have our past reports on the case at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
Join the family. Civic Media has a number of great jobs across the state open now at civicmedia.us/careers.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
My name is Jim Santel. This is Amicus, a law review. We are talking about the foreseeable consequences of this continuing practice of the Supreme Court to issue all these emergency docket orders, one sentence, two sentences, three, four, five, not providing instruction to the lower judiciary, not providing description to us about the reason why it's doing all these things, now coming to roost, coming home. And the situation prompts a fracturing inside the judiciary itself about what is supposed to happen here. You've got William Young, who has now found himself having to apologize effectively to Justices Kavanaugh and Gorsuch because he unknowingly failed to interpret a one-sentence order in a case involving education grants to a pending case in front of him involving NIH grants. And we've got Judge Young taking the high road, very contrite, very above all of this, and saying, listen, I had no intention of violating what the Supreme Court had done. He says, in fact, that I have served as judicial officer for over 47 years. Never before this admonition that I've gotten by the Supreme Court has any judge in any higher court ever thought to suggest that this court has defied the precedent of a higher court. That was never my intention. He went out of his way in stressing that it was never clear to him that this court's emergency application and its ruling in that education case
one sentence, represented its thinking in other instances of federal grants the Trump administration has also slashed. He said, "I simply did not understand that orders on the emergency docket were precedent. I stand corrected." Interestingly, here's your civics footnote for the day. In a 2021 speech, Justice Sam Alito said, "A ruling on emergency application is not precedent." Is the confusion any more profound than it could be here? Judge Young is 84 years old. He's still on the bench. He's a senior judge. He was confirmed as a federal judge before either of the justices, Kavanaugh or Gorsuch, who criticized him, who admonished him and scolded him. He's sitting as a federal judge even before any of the two justices had started law school. And he says the justices' rebuke were nothing they had seen in nearly five decades as a judge. This is falling apart. This is falling apart. And indeed, if you think the story is over, it is not. Because in the wake of all of this mess caused by the Supreme Court and completely at the feet of the Chief Justice who permits all this to happen, we've got Stephen Breyer. This is not Charles Breyer, the judge, the district court judge in Central California. It's his brother, Stephen Breyer. They are brothers. Justice Stephen Breyer, as you know well, also formerly of the Supreme Court. Justice Stephen Breyer comes to the defense of Judge Young and says he praises Judge Young. And he says he's a model jurist whose rulings he had often reviewed during his 14 years in appeals court in Boston. And Judge Breyer, without mentioning Gorsuch or Kavanaugh, who admonished Judge Young, says this. He says, "I never saw an instance where he, Judge Young, would deliberately defy a controlling opinion of legal statement from our court or from the Supreme Court. I never even had an instinct or a guess or a hunch or anything that he was doing anything like that deliberately." You've got a former Supreme Court justice telling present Supreme Court justices to back off, to say that your criticism of this outstanding, multi-decade tenured judge on the bench who's doing his job as best he can is wrong. And again, Justice Stephen Breyer admonishing now Justices Kavanaugh and Gorsuch for their condemnation of Judge Young. That's the situation we are in these days. Justice Breyer said he knows that Judge Young would never have done that. He said he was honest. He was a straightforward judge, a very decent person, and a good judge. That's Justice, now former Justice Stephen Breyer, telling Justice Gorsuch and Justice Kavanaugh, effectively, that they're wrong about this. Clean up your act. Give all of the judges, including Judge Young and others, instruction, and maybe they'll do a better job in trying to interpret what it is that's coming out of the Supreme Court. And yet there's more. There is more this past week, more judicial disarray, more fraying at the corners and right in the middle. Let's begin to talk about the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. That's the First Circuit, again, including Massachusetts and other New England states. What is the Fourth Circuit? The Fourth Circuit is Maryland. You know that because we've talked a lot about those cases, including the Abrego Garcia case coming up from Judge Zinnes, going up to Harvey Wilkinson, who we'll hear from again. Fourth Circuit includes Maryland and Virginia, West Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, kind of the central Atlantic states there. The Fourth Circuit this past week, also, not just scratching its collective head, but bemoaning the fact that the Supreme Court, once again, is not doing its job in providing instruction to the lower courts. They're on the bench. They're in an en banc proceeding this past week, all of them together, and they're questioning whether they still had a role to play in the adjudication of cases in front of them because of the lack of clarity coming out of the Supreme Court. They are asking whether they should simply reiterate the high court's orders and leave it at that, not resolve any things. Here is what one of the judges on the Fourth Circuit said. They're leaving the circuit courts, the district courts, out in a limbo. That's from Judge James Wynn. And he says this during oral arguments this past week in a case about the Musk team's access to Social Security data. That's the case under which this comes up. And Judge Wynn, again, Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, said, "We're out here flailing, flailing, he says. He says, I'm not criticizing the justices. Well, I think you are, Judge Wynn. He says, they're using a vehicle that's there, but they are telling us nothing. They could easily just give us direction and we would follow it. And goes on to say they cannot get an amnesia in the future because they didn't write an opinion on it. Write an opinion. When we come back, I'll tell you more about what the Fourth Circuit did this past week. And then we'll go on to other rule of law issues in America, including issues related to the First and the Second Amendments here on Amicus, a law review.
This is locally grown radio. WFHR 1320 AM. W248DE Wisconsin Rapids. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Heather Bosch.
There have been 14,000 threats against members of Congress just this calendar year.
And Republican Senator James Lankford tells CBS's Face the Nation concerns are only growing after a political influencer was shot dead at an event in Utah last week. CBS's Christian Benavidez.
CBS News has learned the Trump administration is sending a $58 million request to Congress to increase security for members of the executive and judicial branches in light of the assassination of conservative political activist Charlie Kirk.
The president says he also supports increasing congressional security. FBI Director Kash Patel is facing questions about his handling of the Kirk investigation. CBS's Scott McFarlane explains.
The grades are incomplete right now. It was the father who seems to have turned in his son in this case, and the FBI director was caught with some social media.